with a public hearing on House Bill 2518. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee.
House Bill 2518 comes to you from Representative Green Lake. This bill allows the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board, upon request by an applicant, to extend the 30-day time limit that the applicant has to request reconsideration of an order issued by the board, or for the board to notify the applicant of its decision on reconsideration. This bill passed the House unanimously.
Okay, and we have Representative Greenlick here. Welcome. Welcome, Mrs. Greenlick.
Sorry, she's here to make sure I get where I'm supposed to go.
Well, I think you should bring her up here with you. We know who did all the work.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Mitch Greenlick, Representative House District 33, Northwest Portland, West to North Plains. House Bill 2518 is a very simple bill. It's here because I had a constituent who had to file an appeal before the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board, and when she got the notice of appeal, it turned out that her attorney was out of the country or something, and it was hard for her to get the hearing on her appeal within the 30-day statutory limit for the board. When I checked with Senator Minnis, who happens to be here today, who had just taken over that job, it turned out that there was this statutory requirement that the board respond within 30 days after an appeal was filed, and it turned out he was very kind. He stood on his head to make sure that the appeal could be heard by, I think, calling a special meeting of the board within that 30 days, but we both commented on how it would be much simpler for the board and for other applicants, public safety employees, to have a little room in that 30-day extension, and this bill simply allows the board to have an extra 30 days for either the filing of the appeal or the response to an appeal if it's on the request of the applicant and for good cause shown. And the agency is here in the presence of Senator Minnis and Marilyn Lorenz, who testified in favor of this before the House, and they say if you'd like, they'll be willing to show their support for it.
Thank you very much. The questions from the committee? Okay, we do have Mr. Minnis in the audience. Would you like to talk or would you like the bill?
Okay, we're close.
That sounds like deja vu all over again.
A direct quote from our former esteemed chair of this committee. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2518 and open a work session on House Bill 2518. Senator Starr.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2518 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2518 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry this? Senator Pozanski has volunteered. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2499. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2499 comes to you from Representative Schaffler. This bill removes the requirement that children attending high school must maintain a C average or better to continue receiving child support. Currently, Oregon is one of 17 states that requires obligor spouses to pay child support to children who are attending post-secondary education. In order for these children to receive this child support, they must meet certain requirements. One of them is maintaining a C average or better. The second requirement is to notify the parent paying support when the child stops attending school. And the third is to submit a form to the parent and the Department of Justice that contains all the information necessary to establish eligibility, such as the grades and the courses. Again, this bill only applies to children that are attending high school. It does not apply to children attending post-secondary school.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pozanski.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler was here prior to your arrival. He asked me to put on the record that he was willing to testify, but he went back to the floor because they're working bills today. He told me that this is a good bill. It should pass. He also stated that he thought that this bill may be included in a larger bill that may have already been had some type of action on it. He didn't tell me the bill number, but I told him I'd tell you this on the record, so it'd be part of the record that he thought it was something that should go forward, but he thought it may already be covered in another bill.
Okay, well, we have two witnesses signed up, so maybe one or both of them can provide some insight. Shaney Fuller and Sybil Hebb.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Shaney Fuller and I'm with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. The Child Support Program is neutral on this bill. As stated, Senate Bill 1050, which was heard last week, I believe, is a more comprehensive bill on the topic of child attending school. It removes the C grade average altogether and replaces it with satisfactory academic progress. This bill simply removes the C grade average for the child attending high school. Currently, the child support program does allow some flexibility for high school students in that arena because some different things may have been happening prior to them turning 18, and so we allow them to either have a cumulative grade average or a per term after they would turn 18, so the next full semester after they turn age 18, if they are maintaining that C grade average, we do continue on in enforcing their child support.
Okay, and what about schools that have no grades, pass, no pass, or that type of thing?
Chair Burdick, we have defined that as a C grade average equivalent, and so normally that is a pass, no pass, and whatever kind of grading system that the institution uses, if they're passing, we would consider that to be equivalent to a C grade average.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. It is Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. I'll just be very brief and echo Ms. Fuller's comments and also just voice our support in of the public policy behind this bill, which is to facilitate the completion of high school or GED programs. And this bill would clear up some confusion that sometimes exists over how that the current law should be applied. So.
Okay. Thank you. Do either of you know about other bills working their way through the process?
Bill 1050.
Chair Burdick, that is Senate Bill 1050, and I believe that was last week or the week before that you heard that and passed it out of committee. It is waiting to be heard on the Senate floor.
Okay. I was visiting my own planet when you said that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well,
Madam Chair.
Senator Pruzanski.
I think that's the bill that we had that included our staff person from the Democratic Caucus office as to the dilemma that she had. I think it was a very inclusive, broad bill. That this was just a component of it.
That is correct.
What we'll do is we will, I'm very interested in moving the substance of this bill, but I think we'll wait and see what happens to 1050 and bring this back later in the week if we need to. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2499 and open a public hearing on
work session. We just need to reconsider that.
This one. Okay. Okay. We will open a work session where we will take up a possible reconsideration on House Bill 2359. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2359A.
Senator Starr has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2359A. To your motion? Nope, it's non-debatable. Those of the opinion that the rules be suspended can remain silent, and those who are in favor of it can also remain silent. Is there any objection? Thank you. These scripts always mix me up. Okay, the motion is suspended. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2359A was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2359A was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Council, can you enlighten us what the issue is here?
Yeah, this just needs to be reconsidered for conflict amendments.
Okay. All right. Is there any other discussion? Any objection? The motion to reconsider is adopted. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move the 8-2 amendments to resolve the conflicts in House Bill 2359A.
Senator Starr has moved the 8-2 amendments to resolve conflicts to House Bill 2359A. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Okay, Senator Starr.
Let's see.
Bottom of the page.
Yeah, I move House Bill 2359A to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2359 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Walker will still carry this bill. Thank you. Okay. Now we will, I'm going to go a little out of the order, the announced order here, and take up a work session. That's it for you, isn't it? We'll take up a work session on Senate Bill 65. No, we won't. Council isn't here.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 65 comes to you. We've already had a hearing on this bill. It comes to you from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and what the bill does is that under the Yastery Amendments, the measure authorizes the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to impose civil penalties not to exceed $1,500 on public safety agency for violation of statutes prohibiting employment of uncertified employees. That creates a presumption that public safety agencies that terminates or reassigns employees solely because employee fails to meet certification standards is acting in good faith and is immune from civil liability for the termination or reassignment unless lack of good faith is shown by clear and convincing evidence. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for pinch-hitting, Council. We have Mr. Minnis here. If anybody has any questions, it's a pretty straightforward bill. We have a dash 3 amendment to it. Are there questions from the committee?
No, Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
It would seem to me that this this bill might make it very difficult for small police agencies to and other agencies to work effectively. And it is unclear how some of these smaller agencies would be able to fund this this training. And in some of the smaller communities, it is perhaps better to have an officer who is not 100% trained than to have no officer at all. And so as this is as presented, I don't believe I can support it.
Okay. Mr. Minnis, do you have any comments on that point that was raised?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I guess I would say in response to your question that the vicarious liability...
Identify yourself for the record.
My name is John Menace, and I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The vicarious liability that might attach to someone who's not fully trained or is uncertified may very well be a liability that that city would not want to have as part of their program. City-county insurance, quite frankly, advises many small cities through the League of Oregon Cities and other organizations around the state to pay very close attention to issues just like this. So I would be very careful about not wanting fully certified and trained police officers working within those jurisdictions. I would say to the committee that the intent of the agency certainly is not to act as a policeman to the extent that we're going to go out chasing people around and imposing civil penalties against public agencies willy-nilly. I think the objective here is to try to get folks to comply with orders by the agency to not employ a certified officer in a certified position. But it's a little word of wisdom, I guess, is I think your city county insurance, city councils, and city administrators might be a little concerned about not having certified officers working.
Madam Chair, just two things. One of them is it probably is not the desire of these smaller municipalities not to want to have them certified. It may be that they can't afford to do that. And secondly, Director Minnis, as we know, it's not the intent of your agency, it's the wording of the law that's important.
I'm sure. Thank you.
Senator Pazanski, did you have a question?
I do. John, on the amount of the fine of not exceeding $1,500 per violation, and how is that going to be figured if you had information that a city did in fact have someone that was not certified, would it be for each day that they're actually out in the field working? Or I guess my concern is making sure this does not become the cost of doing business.
Madam Chair and Senator Brzezinski, again, a person could read a violation in a hyper-technical sense and perhaps find that every day an individual works would be an independent violation. Again, I don't think that's the intent of the agency. Our intent is to get organizations to comply, and I think much like the issue you have with the technical assistance side of health and safety issues in the workplace, it's really incumbent upon this department to try to assure smaller jurisdictions and other organizations have access to adequate training so they can be certified. So although it is possible that any administrator, or bad administrator, at least in my opinion, that would not be serving in the best interest of the state could attach multiple violations, I don't think that's in the best interest of the agency. I don't think it's in the best interest of law enforcement. And quite frankly, I think many of these chiefs and sheriffs would come back to this organization suggesting that they don't approve of the legislation. And so I think that one of the issues you need to perhaps keep in mind is that this legislation was authorized by the board. It is made up of chiefs and sheriffs and other organizations from, you know, to make up the full complement of the 24-member board. So they're fully aware of what the bill does and what it's intended to do. And I think our most egregious violation of this actually came with a private sector company that was employing an emergency medical dispatcher who had been convicted of robbery in the second degree that continued in employment notwithstanding the revocation of their certification. So I don't think that the incidents where it arises in our agency is that frequent to begin with, but there are some. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Some of the smaller communities in my area have contracted with sheriff or with other agencies to provide policing in their communities where they're unable to find and hire full-time trained competent staff. Is that something that's common in other areas of the state?
Madam Chair and Senator Starr, yes it is. In fact, the city that I live in, Wood Village, contracts with Multnomah County for police services. It's simply too small of an organization or city to fund a fully staffed police agency, so it's very common. In fact, I believe the city of Newburgh is currently in the process of contracting with the city of Dundee to provide police services because Dundee has found it difficult financially to support an entire police agency.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Senator Barr.
Thank you. John, you said that it was a private security force, but the bill speaks of public safety agencies as who can be fined. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, that's correct. The private entity that I was dealing with or mentioned earlier was Metro West Ambulance Company. Some members of the legislature may have received some communication on behalf of the individual that was revoked. That particular entity comes under the public safety domain. Private security currently has its own set of statutes in Chapter 181 that allow for civil penalty in the private security sector. We currently do not have the civil penalty authority for public safety agencies.
So, as a clarification, Madam Chair, you could, or you have the authority now to assess civil penalties against a private security company but not against a city?
That's correct.
Thanks. Any more questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 65 and open a work session on Senate Bill 65. Senator Starr, we have a Dash 3 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 65.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 65. Is there any discussion? Objections? Dash 3 adopted. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 65 as amended to the Senate floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 65 to the Senate floor as amended for the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection?
Yes. No. Objection.
You object?
Objection.
Okay. Would you call the roll? Thank you.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Pedrosky?
Aye.
Senator Ringo? Excuse me. Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitfield?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Bill 65 is adopted. I will carry it. Okay. Now we will open a work session on, are we ready on 1041, Council Taylor? Are we ready on 1041?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we are ready.
We will open a work session on Senate Bill 1041. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1041 comes to you from Senator Gordley's office, and the bill creates a civil cause of action against a person who has committed custodial interference in either the first or second degree. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you the dash four amendments, which are similar to the amendments we last had before the committee in work session, which was last week, with the main difference on page 2, lines 6 through 10. It's an affirmative defense to civil liability for an action under this section that the defendant reasonably in good faith believe the defendant violated custodial interference in first and second degree was necessary to preserve the physical safety of the defendant or the person who was taken, enticed, or kept in violation of those two provisions. Madam Chairman of the Committee. In relationship to that, going back to page 1, lines 13 through 15, it also creates, if you violated these provisions, a prima facie evidence of liability. So if you were convicted of those offenses, it would be prima facie evidence that you were civilly liable. Nonetheless, you could raise under this section the defense that it was necessary to preserve the physical safety of the defender or the person who was taken.
Okay, so the criminal conviction would not prejudice your ability to use that defense?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, it would not. But it would be prima facie evidence.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions with counsel? We're in work session, and we have a dash 4 amendment in front of us.
We have a dash 4. Hmm?
No, you're not, but it's just new. I mean, compared to what we've looked
at. I don't even have a dash 4.
It's in our pile. He just went over the changes in the dash 4. I apologize if... Would you again highlight the differences between the dash 4 and the dash 3?
I'm sure the sole difference between the two amendments is going into page 2, lines 6 through 10. It is an affirmative defense to civil liability for an action under this section. The defendant reasonably and in good faith believed that the defendant's violation of custodial interference in first or second degree was necessary to preserve the physical safety of the defendant or the person who was taken, enticed, or kept in violation of those two provisions. And where that particularly relates is going back to page 1, where it talks about its prima facie evidence that a violation of those two provisions. And those, what it means is the prima facie evidence, even though you were convicted of those crimes, you could nonetheless, in the civil action, raise the defense that you did so in good faith, believing that the defendants, it was necessary to preserve the physical safety of the defendant or the person who was taken or enticed.
Senator Whitsitt?
Council, on section 2 on the second page, section 1 of this 2005 act applies to all causes of action whether arising before, on, or after the effective date. Does this make this act retroactive?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, you're 100% correct. It does. It would apply to actions on or after or before the effective date. So it took place 5-6 years ago, and the statute of limitations had not run. You could maintain the cause of action.
Madam Chair, if you're looking for comments on this, I'm not going there.
Okay. We have Belissa Seidlick, who is wanted to comment on a fiscal impact, I presume. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Belissa Seidlick, Family Law Senior Policy Analyst. And before I make my remarks about the fiscal impact, I just want to emphasize that the department is supportive of the policy considerations that are underlying this bill, and as a matter of fact, will be participating in and sponsoring educational and training opportunities on parental abduction in the next year or two. However, what we are most concerned about, and I testified about this at the public hearing on the bill, and I do not believe the amendments adequately address these concerns. The department is concerned that this bill will open the proverbial floodgates for high-conflict families in domestic relations and family abuse proceedings. And we have about 17,000 dissolution cases and 14,000 family abuse proceedings each year, about 75% of those involve children. If even a small amount, 10% of those, become high conflict and decide to avail themselves of this remedy as a means of either harassing the other party or trying to reach some kind of resolution they're not happy with in the underlying domestic relations proceeding about custody and parenting time, then we're looking at a tremendous number of cases coming into the courts. And it is the department's concern that the language in the bill, including the amendments and the Dash 4 amendments, are not narrowly drawn enough. Anyone who has, I believe the language is, whose custodial rights have been interfered with, where a missing person has been reported to the police, may file such an action. And it's not at all clear that all you need to do is pick up a phone and make a report to the authorities in order to qualify for that requirement. I believe Professor Merle Weiner also had some written testimony at the prior work session where she pointed out that what happens if this person, the defendant in a custodial interference prosecution, is acquitted or is not convicted or the charges are dismissed, then still a cause of action can be brought under this statute as it's mentioned or as it exists now. And with respect to the retroactive effect of the bill and the extended statute of limitations, the statute of limitations is told for the entire period of time that a child is taken out of state. And I understand that this takes place quite frequently. And so you might conceivably have causes of action that are brought for acts that happened 18 to 24 years ago. So thus, while the intent of the bill is a good one, we definitely see the courts wanting to address the issue of parental abduction, but not through opening the floodgates for a cause of action by parents against each other and their family members.
Would you find it would help the fiscal a lot to take away the retroactive part of it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that would help, but actually the fiscal effect is quite high even without taking into account the retroactive effect, and this is because of the numbers that I stated earlier on and the possibility of high-conflict families using this as a tool.
Senator Pruzanski.
And also, would it be because if the statute's toll, while the child's out of the state, I mean, you could have 18 years before you bring the suit. So it's going to have a devastating effect as to how many people could potentially be involved in this, not even considering the retroactiveness of someone not being, quote-unquote, on notice before the acts were committed.
Are there any questions or comments from this side of the podium? Senator Starr.
Yes, I know there's a very real problem, as evidenced by testimony of Sean and many others who contacted me. You indicated that there's going to be some activity to address this. How can we reasonably provide justice for those parents who've been unreasonably subjected to this abduction?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, There are existing statutes that individuals can take advantage of and apply to the court for relief. Getting temporary custody orders, getting writs of assistance or orders of assistance, having the court address the fact that a child is being hidden or secreted away from another parent on an emergency basis. And I believe that that kind of keeps the process civilized as opposed to providing parents with weapons to use against each other, such as, well, I will sue you for a civil action and get damages. There are existing statutes that can be used, and that is going to be one of the focuses for the trainings that are being discussed currently by members of the Parental Abduction Task Force, of which I am one, a member. And so hopefully with some awareness of other existing remedies, as well as education that is taking place in domestic relations proceedings, all parents with children going through dissolutions or separations must take a parental education class. And those classes are starting to include information on parental alienation and parental abduction.
Madam Chair, it just seems to me from the reports of individuals involved that it's really inadequate to address a situation where the child's stolen away and they don't know where they are. And to my feeling and understanding about the situation, there's a terrible abuse going on. Mm-hmm. Those who would abduct their children. So I'm not satisfied that we're adequately addressing the issue by current law, and hopeful that we can do something that provides some real remedies with teeth that parents can at least face that one who has stolen the children away. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Senator Whitsitt, did you have a comment?
Yes, sir. I really can't support this bill. I think it was pretty eloquently stated from the witness chair. I don't think there's not enough protection for incidental disputes here. Another thing, there's unilateral attorney fees, so that if you're the plaintiff, you can get attorney fees, but if you're the defendant, you can't. I have a real problem with the measure of emotional distress 18 to 24 years later, and then the retroactiveness of the bill. I share Sean's concern and Senator Starr's concern that perhaps we're not adequately addressing this issue, but I don't think this is the right vehicle for it.
Okay, and could you share with us again what your plans are for the future on the overall issue of parental abduction for the task force?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can speak on behalf of the Judicial Department, which is participating in conjunction with mental health professionals, law enforcement officers, to look at this issue, as well as the Commission on Children and Family. Mickey Lansing, the director of that entity, is pulling together a symposium that will be taken statewide and will look at parental abduction and the problems that exist in connection with it from all these different perspectives, not just the court, but law enforcement, mental health, families.
And do you anticipate any legislative proposals coming out of that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it hasn't been discussed fully enough yet. We aren't to that point. I would not want to say it's not a possibility. I think a lot of the problem stems from lack of awareness about the issue. So I think the first step is educating professionals in the multidisciplinary sense about the problem.
Senator Pisanski.
Madam Chair, thank you. It seems to me that if this is going to go out public and you're going to be doing some type of education, one of the things I would request is that we look at what is happening in other states, what is the model, if there's a national model, as to deal with this. I agree with what I've heard from other members, Madam Chair. There's definitely a problem here. There's a significant problem. But the solution that proposed here doesn't seem to me to really get to the underlying issues and will, in fact, I think, become much more combative and without other means of dealing with this. That's, let's say, something that's been modeled and shown. I mean, we can't be the only ones in this country, and there's got to be something out there that we can draw on that we can maybe use within this education process, and if necessary, bring something back that will give a little bit more balanced means of use of the legal system for addressing these issues.
Thank you very much. Committee, I think we've got some problems with this measure. So at this time, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1041, and we will take, we will next go to a public hearing on House Bill 2268. Council.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2268 comes to you at the request of the Joint Union Judiciary Committee for the Oregon Law Commission. It requires that if an appraisal or condemnation action relies on a written report, opinion, or estimate of a person who is not an appraiser, then the appraisal must have an attached copy of the report, opinion, or estimate. It requires that if the appraisal relies on an unwritten report, opinion, or estimate of a person who is not an appraiser, then the name and address of the person who provided that information must also be included. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we last had a hearing on this bill on May 2nd, and at that time we did hear from one witness, an attorney in Portland, Donald Joe Willis, but he was actually in favor of the bill but was hoping that we would add something else to it, and I think he took care of that matter in another bill on the House side. We have, this bill is, we've had a hearing, but I believe it's listed for a work session today inadvertently, and we do have Jerry Watson and Wendy Johnson here who could testify on the bill.
Tell me that again. It's scheduled for a public hearing.
I know, Madam Chair. We've already had a hearing on the bill.
Correct.
On May 2nd.
So are you saying that there are people here who want to testify on it?
I don't know. I haven't seen the sign-up sheet.
Okay.
Right. But I know Wendy Johnson is here, and Jerry Watson is here from the Oregon Law Commission.
Last one. Okay.
It's scheduled for a hearing.
All right. We did have it for a hearing. So, Wendy, why don't you come on up in case there's any questions? But we did have a hearing on this. This is one where I held it over because there was somebody who wanted to testify on it who wasn't able to stay, and that person's concerns have been addressed. And I don't think anybody on the committee had a problem with the bill, but maybe you can elaborate on that, Wendy.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Council Taylor has explained the bill. If I had to summarize it, it's like a math problem. You have to show your work. Oregon law already requires an exchange of appraisals when property is to be condemned. It's difficult for a property owner to determine whether that number is an adequate number or is based on, you know, reasonable information without having all the information that the appraiser relied upon. This bill would require an exchange of the reports that the appraiser relied upon, if there were written reports, if there was not a written document that the appraiser relied upon, any if he got an oral report, then you just need to exchange the telephone number and the name, so the property owner or the government, it works both ways, could find out the information. Condemnation is getting more and more complicated, and so, for example, there might be a mineral report or an engineer's report or something else that the appraiser relied upon. So basically, it's just requiring to show your work. There's no extra cost because it's only those reports that were already generated. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Close the hearing on House Bill 2268. There are no amendments. Open a work session on House Bill 2268. Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2268 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Walker will carry this as a member of the Law Commission. Okay. Now we will open... Now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill... I don't see Scott Bricker in here.
He was.
Was he here? House Bill 2742. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2742A comes to you from the House Committee on Transportation. This measure would establish a Safe Routes to Schools Fund and require the Department of Transportation to apply for, accept, receive, and disperse such monies from the federal government for purposes, and from other sources for that matter, for purposes of assisting communities in identifying and reducing barriers and hazard to children walking or cycling to and from school. The measure also allows the department to provide assistance in evaluation and measurement of community programs, technical services and advice, and public education. It would permit any city, county, or school district that has developed or is preparing to develop such a plan to apply for and receive assistance. It would require the Department of Transportation to adopt rules establishing the criteria which it will use in awarding the grants. The background on this is that Congress is considering new federal highway funding reauthorization, which is expected to include funding sources for this program, and Oregon could receive as much as $2 million annually from this legislation.
Thank you very much. We have three people signed up: Troy Costello, Scott Bricker, and Julie Warnke. Start. You signed up first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. Members of the committee, my name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Council has done a great job of outlining what this bill does. Just like to highlight a couple things for you. This is not the school zone bill. This is not the school zone amber light bill. This is related to Safe Routes to Schools, which is a program that's been around for quite a few years from a program side of people getting together talking about removing barriers for children walking, bicycling to and from school. What Congress has done, as Council has indicated, is Congress has put into both the original House bill and then the Senate amended bill at the federal level money that would go to states for Safe Routes to Schools. We do not know what the exact number is going to be. We also do not know what particular strings the U.S. Department of Transportation will put on this program as well. So this is getting out in front of the program, expecting it to happen before you come back in for your next session. The Safety Division has a lot of programs like this dealing with communities and grants, and have a well-established process of reaching out all across the state. And so what this statute does is it gives us direction once we see the numbers from Congress and the rules from U.S. Department of Transportation of what we're supposed to do. It will mean that ODOT and the Safety Division will come back to the Emergency Board in order to get spending authority and interposition authority if it's needed, based on what the federal bill says. Currently, one version of the bill says the state will have a known named coordinator for Safe Routes to School. So I'd have to evaluate as the manager of the division whether I capitalize on a position that's already there and change the person's duties, or do I come to you requesting an FTE that goes with this program. Our programs do approach it on the 4E of emergency medical services, the engineering efforts, the enforcement efforts, and the education efforts, and we would do the same underneath this bill should it pass and be signed into law. And Madam Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions that may come up.
Thank you. This has a fiscal on it. Has it already been through the budget process?
Madam Chair, the House bill, as amended, removed the reference to Ways and Means because we don't know what the number is going to be from Congress because they've not finished their deliberations yet. So the ODOT fiscal was indeterminate as far as saying how much do we think is actually going to hit this upcoming biennium or the biennium after. So the department is comfortable coming back to the Emergency Board once we do know how it's been handled, and that's the same pattern that the budget committees this past week for ODOT have brought up other elements that Congress is debating, adding new money, new responsibilities to ODOT. The budget committee said come back later when you know what the exact number is. So,
okay. And in any event, it's federal funds that we're talking about here.
Madam Chair, would assume that the majority of the funds there are federal. It does. The bill does allow us to get other grants or other donations, et cetera, that might be deemed aimed at safe routes to school. For instance, in the state of Washington, they have double fines in their school zones. The double fine amount in the state of Washington goes into a safe routes to school fund that the Washington Highway Safety Office uses to help with crossing guards, sidewalks, et cetera, for movement around schools. This opens up the ability for that to occur in Oregon as well at some point in time should the legislature deem that appropriate.
Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under this bill, it gives the authority for the department to gather this this monies and gifts and grants, et cetera, and then disperse. Do you actually have to come back before the Ways and Means or the budget process to get authorization to disperse, or is this automatic based on being a pass-through?
Chair and Senator Pazansky, my assumption is that we have the authority to move forward because already in statute under the safety division, it says we have to work cooperatively with other public agencies and cities and counties and pass those grants through as long as we're following all the rules of the funds at the federal and state level.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. So I think you just answered my question, but you don't really need a bill to apply for these grants then, do you? You've already got the authority to do that.
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, under current statute authority, the Safety Division has the authorization to apply for U.S. Department of Transportation safety-related grants that comes through the federal authorization program.
Okay, follow-up. Where does the money go if we don't pass the bill and you apply for grants and get them? Where does the money go?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, if this bill does not pass, current statute allows the Safety Division to apply for the program, and the only rules that we would be following as far as saying how do we divide the money up or what do we use it for were based on the U.S. Department of Transportation rules. What this bill does is adds a state level of rules and concern and areas that my office would have to use the money for, so it shrinks the flexibility down and makes it a little bit tighter for what we would be able to do.
Another one?
Please, Senator.
Can, under current law, can any other agency apply for grants, like schools, counties, anything else, or does it have to go through the state through you?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration funds that are made available through congressional allocation must flow through the Highway Safety Office of the state. In some occasions, NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, creates programs where people can apply direct, but they have to have the Highway Safety Office concurrence to turn it in, but it will go direct to the local, would not flow through the Safety Division office.
Any more questions, Senator Barr?
Not right now, thanks.
Thank you. Other questions,
Thank
Senator
Chair.
Whitsitt?
Mr. Castelli, would this plan, would this in any way affect land use planning, restrict community, commercial, or industrial development, alter automobile access or parking, or create authorization for eminent domain action?
Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the requirement for a school district or for a road authority to apply for these funds is they've had to have had that conversation locally and have had a safe routes to school plan agreed upon locally. It's my assumption that if they're doing some sort of impact to the amount of lane capacity or some other issue around transportation that they're dealing with their local plans and whatever may be in front of them, we are not going to have the authority to say yes or no on some of the things that you have listed there. That's going to be incumbent upon the local jurisdiction to make sure that they've figured it out and have everything checked accordingly. Most of the time, what these funds are talking about, for instance, would be extending sidewalks where there are none between where inside the no-bus zone around a school. There are kids walking to and from school that don't have sidewalks. So some of these funds would deal with the sidewalk issue. Some of these funds could be used for crossing guard material. Some of these things could be for repatterning the way parents, when they drop their kids off in cars, separating the bicycles away from where the cars are so you're not trying to put them in conflict. So it's not, I don't expect, particularly with the volume of the money, we're only talking $500,000 to $2 million a year, you're not going to get into too much of an infrastructure road redesign when this money is only expected to be around for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, please. Mr. Costello, are the decisions on these plans made by elected officials, or would they be by a stakeholder group, or they would be made by the Transportation Safety Committee?
Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the decision will be made by the local school district and the local road authority, whether that's the city or the county, and in some cases it would be if it's a state highway that they're talking about. This requires them, and already in 2001, the legislature already passed a requirement that school districts and road authorities talk about safe routes to and from school. That's not a new requirement, and those decisions are locally. They're not held at the safety division level.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I heard the answer to that question. You did say that the Transportation Safety Committee would not be involved in making those rules, but would this be like a parent group or a stakeholder group, or would it be elected officials who actually make these decisions?
Madam Chair, and Senator Whitsitt, it would be the school district itself and whoever the road authority, whether it's the city government, the county government, or state government, that they are addressing in their plan.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Mr. Bricker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Bricker, and I'm Policy Director at the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and also represent the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, so it's walking and biking interests. We help put this bill forward, and I don't want to spend too much time describing what it is because I think we've already gone over that. But I do want to state a couple of the intents that we had here and some of the high level of support we've had around the bill. One of the major reasons we brought this bill forward was to give local and to write into statute that locals would have control over the Safe Routes to School grant applications that they submitted. If Oregon received between $500,000 or $2 million a year, we wanted to ensure that local communities could apply for that money for the things that they saw most fit. And specifically working with the ODOT Transportation Safety Division, headed by Mr. Casales next to me, who have done a great job working with communities already and doing traffic safety grants in the past. Those grants would be eligible not only for engineering projects, but also education and enforcement as well. And so that was one of the things I wanted to throw in there. If there was a school zone and there was kids need to cross a certain street and there needs to be enhanced enforcement, that also could be eligible underneath this grant. So it provides basically a flexible mean for local communities to work together to identify problems in front of schools and to apply for grants to solve those needs. And also, my understanding of the way this is written and the intent is that also what would also be eligible would be that funding process, I mean the planning process. So if cities and counties wanted to work with school districts, they could actually get some money to develop those plans. Finally, I just wanted to mention, and on the second page of my testimony, there are a number of communities already seeking these types of programs as far south as Ashland and Medford, all the way up the Willamette Valley, Central Oregon, and north of Portland. There are other communities that have expressed interest as well, but there haven't been funds for this type of activity before. The public hearing on the House side was held in Central Oregon in Bend. Representative Brewer was chairing that meeting, member of the vice chair of the Transportation Committee, and we had a really positive turnout for that hearing, and it included a coalition of people that was included the school district, the city, the local hospital, Healthy Kids Coalition, the Safe Kids Coalition, Commute Options, which is a group that looks at how to get around for adults and kids by bicycling, walking, and transit, and some other concerned citizens. Eventually, this bill passed the House 58-0. So we feel really positive about this bill and hope that you'd be willing to move it out of committee today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Warnicki, and I am the Transportation Planning Manager in the Public Works Department at the City of Salem. And I am here today in support of House Bill 2742. It is important to the city to provide our children with safe ways to get to school. While this has always been an important issue, the need was driven home 1 year ago when an elementary school student was killed in a tragic accident while waiting for a school bus along a busy arterial here in Salem. This accident was a tragedy for all involved, but the point I want to make in bringing this up today is that the only reason this boy and others in this area are being bused to the elementary school that is less than 1 mile away is because that the walking conditions to get to school were not considered safe. As a public works department, we are frequently confronted with requests for engineering solutions to specific school access needs, such as crosswalks, crossing improvements, sidewalks, additional shoulder width and improvements, or lighting. We have a history of coordinating with the school district and neighborhood associations to identify needs and then seeking funds to address these needs. However, the available funding is not sufficient to meet identified needs. An identified funding source that targets safe routes to school would help the city in our effort to work with schools and the community to identify and appropriately address needs. Resources available for planning are an important part of this equation, since any effective program needs to incorporate more than just engineering. Enforcement and education are keys to creating a safe environment for children to get to school. In some cases, people look to engineering solutions when other efforts would actually be more effective, or when engineering alone would not be the best use of limited resources. In addition to our involvement in engineering solutions, the Salem Public Works Department has been looking to get more involved in efforts to promote walking and bicycling to school. Mid-Valley Rideshare, a program housed at the City of Salem, was involved in promoting International Bike and Walk to School Day in April as part of the Healthy Active Oregon Marion County Coalition. Mid-Valley Rideshare is also interested in exploring opportunities to work with individual schools to launch programs such as a walking or bicycling school bus. These initial efforts in the Salem area would be greatly enhanced by the availability of local resources provided through House Bill 2742. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you for coming. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will now close the public hearing on this bill. I like this bill a great deal, but we will hold on to it for a couple days and take it up later in the week. And now we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2599, Council. If you would talk about the bill and also talk about the amendment from the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2599 originally, in its original form, exempted from public disclosure personal information about customers of a public body that provides water, sewer, or storm drain services. That was the engross version that passed out of the House. There are two amendments to the bill, both of which would replace the bill in its entirety. The -A4 amendment, if adopted, would allow law enforcement agencies to disclose reports in child abuse cases to authorized treatment providers. My understanding is that while there is one bill that allows law enforcement agencies to disclose these types of reports to the treatment provider who is specifically addressing the child abuse issues, if there are secondary issues such as a drug or alcohol-related addiction, if that addiction is all sort of part of the child abuse cycle, this bill would make it the law enforcement agencies able to give those reports to those authorized treatment providers as well to assist in the rehabilitation of the offender. The -A5 amendment, if adopted,
adopted would clarify when records and other information held by the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board are subject to the public records law. And my understanding is that there was a federal bill called Graham, Leach, and Bliley that obligates the board to keep certain records confidential, while public records law mandates that those records be open to the public. And so the -A5 amendments would, I think, close that gap.
Thank you very much. In committee, I did talk to the appraiser folks, and I think that's a too complicated an issue to take up this late in the game, so I would like to focus the attention of the committee on the A4 amendment and the body of the bill itself.
Just A4 or A5 as well?
Just A4.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
This A4 amendment seems to me to violate the relating to clause of the bill. And I'm wondering how we're able to do that when we were so instructed early on that we would not bring forth amendments that were unrelated to the relating clause.
I think this is okay with this clause, but Council, do you have a comment on
that? In fact, Madam Chair, you may recall Council O'Leary and you and I, as we were looking for a bill to add this particular amendment to, I believe it was you, Madam Chair, who had suggested this bill, and I expressed concern about the relating clause as well, and Council O'Leary spoke with Ms. Vanderbilt in Legislative Council, who felt that the -A4 amendments were fine with this particular relating clause. So it was an issue we explored with LC before sending it down to amend this particular bill.
And was it your sense that it would fit in regardless of whether we kept the original content of the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Starr, does that resolve your concerns about this?
Not really, Madam Chair. The relating clause says water, sewer, and storm drain services.
No, that's a summary.
That's the summary. The relating clause says to public records.
Yeah.
And that was...
Okay. I'm sorry.
Well, I appreciate you being watchful on this. This is getting a point in the session where we're all getting tired, and it's good to have a lot of careful eyes on these. And this bill in particular has been kind of lost in the cracks any number of times. So what we will do now is we've got several people signed up, and some of them are on the A4 and some of them are on the general bill. So we'll start out with Genoa Ingram on the bill itself. And we also have other people in the room who we may drag up at some point. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Genoa Ingram, Oregon Special Districts Association. And if I may I be joined by Libby Henry with EWEB?
Oh, please
do.
Does that
feel right?
Ms. Henry is always welcome in Senate Judiciary.
It's the first time I've been here.
Well, you're always welcome. Just because you never come, it's not our problem.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I am Genoa Ingram, Oregon Special Districts Association, and House Bill 2599 represents a priority bill for the association. I was not aware of any effort to get and stuff our bill until just moments before the hearing, so I'd like to address the original bill. In my efforts to always try and play nice with others, I have no problem with if someone wants to tack on additional amendments. However, I would like to make an argument in favor of keeping the original bill as well as any amendment that may be tacked on.
Yeah, and before you go too much further with this, this was at the direction of the chair, so it wasn't the people who proposed the amendments that took that approach. It was,
thank you, Chair.
It was my direction, but that doesn't mean it has to stay that way.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. In its original form, House Bill 2599 would exempt from public disclosure personal information about customers who obtain their water and sewer service from a special district. Now, currently, if you are a customer of a municipal water and sewer department, such information such as your phone number, your street address, your driver's license number, if it is required, or your social security number is not subject to disclosure. However, the special districts are a special animal, and they are required to turn over such personal information to anyone who requests it. On the House side, we discussed such issues as identity theft, orders of protection where there may be an issue of stalking or spousal abuse or some other type of abuse. And all an individual needs to do, if they're not sure where someone is and they want to find them, regardless of their motives, if they're aware that they live in a particular area, all they need to do is go to the water district and say, I would like your files on your customers. And that person would get a list of customers with the sort of personally identifiable information that I just described. The People's Utility Districts in 1999 recognized how serious the potential for harm was. And in 1999, there was a bill, House Bill 3576, that carved out an exemption for this type of disclosure for the People's Utility Districts. That bill was passed unanimously in the House, and it passed unanimously in the Senate. Now, I'm sure you're on attending legislative business, but I'm sure you would have been a yes. And that bill went on to become law. Likewise, when we introduced our bill in the House and made our case, it was seen by those involved in law enforcement who currently serve in the House of Representatives. They immediately picked up on the types of threats that we were trying to correct, and this bill, again, passed unanimously in the House of Representatives. I understand that... I should preface my further comments by saying that we did work very closely with the newspaper lobbyists. They did provide amendments, and again, we worked very closely with them to make sure that we weren't trying to hinder the press from getting information out that was valuable. We are just trying to prevent personal identifiable information from getting out. This is a good crime prevention bill. There was no opposition to this bill on the House. I've met with no opposition of the bill up to this point. Ms. Henry, I believe, has some comments as far as making the bill a little better, but I would encourage you, if this relating clause is something that you need to further other efforts, that you would leave the original bill intact. We believe it's a good consumer protection bill that your customers of rural districts will find extremely valuable, and I thank you.
I appreciate that. I think the concern that I had about this bill went back to a situation we had in Portland a couple of years ago where we had water rationing because of a drought condition. And Willamette Week newspaper wrote a news article about individual property owners who were staying up all night, apparently, and using huge amounts of water during this rationing period. And given the public policy issues involved, I thought it was a very important news story for them to be able to cover. And my concern about this is whether it would end up protecting people who were protecting people from being accountable for on public policy issues like this.
Chair Burdick, I appreciate that, and I would just offer a couple of comments. Number one, after you originally mentioned that situation to me, I went back and did some checking. That was Tualatin Water District. Now, what's interesting about that situation is, had it been a municipal water district, they would not have been able to get that information.
No, that's wrong. That was the Portland Water Bureau, because I knew some of the people.
Okay.
And they were in my district, a couple of them.
Chair Burdick, I was told it was Tualatin, but be that as it may, the second part of my comment would be, I guess you would need to make a policy issue. Is it as important to broadcast who's using water and leave unprotected those citizens who have an order of protection, or leave them open to identity theft simply because they get their water through a special district as opposed to a municipal? As I understand it, and I did some quick research after visiting with you, that municipal districts are not required to provide personally identifiable information.
Senator Pisanski.
Madam Chair, hearing your concerns, I'm wondering if you want to address those concerns, knowing that this bill deals with special districts and you have to go into the municipal area. Maybe there could be some type of modification as to allowing the information as to the where the meter's at, as to how much water is being actually consumed or used, as compared to going into personal identifiers. I really have to say I support the position. I mean, I signed on to this bill knowing that it would, in fact, give better, greater protections for individuals from the type of identity theft that we've been working on through this session. And it seems to me that maybe the issues that you'd like to address, you could still address those without allowing anyone and everyone's personal identifiers to be open to the public.
That would certainly, because I do feel that there is a very good case to be made for keeping people's names, social security numbers, and it's. I think that's actually a good suggestion if we could find
Thank
a way
Chair.
To tie it to meters.
Thank you, Chair, and I thank Representative Pisanski for your suggestion. It's a good one.
Okay. Other questions from the committee comments?
I co-sponsored it too. Got it.
Well, he's got some skin in the game. Watch out. Okay. Welcome, Libby.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Libby Henry. I represent the Eugene Water and Electric Board. We serve both electricity services and water to the city of Eugene. And I apologize for coming in with this late catch on the language. I'm hoping my fellow utility comrades in the water and electric area will agree with what I have to say. I'm particularly looking at Section 37, on line 34, where it says, well, first, 33 says, we may release this information if the customer consents in writing or electronically.
Madam Chair, can we just get clarification? You said Section 37?
Pardon me, 27. Did I say 37?
We don't
working
have
off
a
with?
Section 27.
What section are we on? Which is the right section? I'm talking about the
All right, if you're looking at the A5,
it's page 4.
Madam Chair, page 4, line 30.
Line 30? 30, actually, go down to 33.
Of the A engrossed.
A engrossed. What are you working off of?
Section, page 4, line 30.
Okay.
Subsection 27.
Right. Okay, line 33 says may release such information, and then it says that the customer consents in writing or electronically. We don't really just trust that kind of information. If it comes in writing or electronically, we still call the customer. We request a driver's license number, or we request the last four digits of Social Security number. Some of our customers actually have passwords. So, it is just simply would add an extra step to what we would be doing to be even more careful and secure about who that customer is who's contacted us. So I would ask if I could work out some amendments to add to writing electronically a personal contact by the utility to the customer by the utility to their satisfaction if they have who they think they're talking to.
Is that agreeable with you, Ms.
Chair? Yes, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think I'd like Kevin Neely to come up here real quickly just on the what the public records applies to and get your comments on Senator Pisanski's suggestion that perhaps we could exempt personal information but still keep make macro information, if you will, available.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, Oregon Department of Justice, representing Attorney General Hardy Myers. we don't have any position on this bill. We've only been watching this bill because it has such a vast relating clause.
That's funny, Madam Chair. I think there are other people in the room. Just that same
thing. Probably
oh,
are.
Hear from them, too, Senator Walker.
I watch those things too carefully at this point. We understand that there are... There's always a necessity to in every possible way protect the identity of individuals, particularly now that ID theft is probably our number one crime, at least number one crime on the increase next to maybe methamphetamine. That said, what I can offer you is that there are already extensive provisions in the public records law or in chapter ORS 192.440. 5 sub 1 that do provide for personal safety issues that do permit extensive exemptions for personal safety. Now, the difference being that in those instances, the customer would have to proactively alert the utility, or in this case, the special district, that they didn't want their information disclosed, whereas the change that you're contemplating today would permit the public body to make the decision. In fact, it doesn't permit any decision at all. Where you're placing this exemption is the non-conditional exemptions. These are exemptions that are 100%. Now, again, as Ms. Henry just pointed out, customers can affirmatively tell the special district or whoever that they want to have that information released. I would add, just in response, and again, I haven't talked to Ms. Henry about this, but even with the particular amendment that she's suggesting, there still is some discretion on behalf of the public body here, or the utility or the municipality or whatever. It's a may, that the public utility may release the information if they are alerted by the customer that the information should be released. They don't have to release that information. They can still withhold it. That is, in fact, a unique feature of this particular number 27 in ORS 192502. That said, I think that the public records law can be manipulated in many, many ways, and if what you want to do is try to craft a mechanism for this, for release of information based on some sort of meter location as opposed to the release of the individual personal identifiers, that seems like a reasonable way to me to address the question of potential identity theft. I can tell you that identity theft is not one of the factors that's considered when getting a personal safety exemption. You cannot say, I fear I'm at risk for identity theft. You can say a whole bunch of other things. You have a restraining order, you have a court order, you're the victim of a crime. Any one of those things qualify you for a personal safety exemption, but the threat of identity theft is not one of the qualifiers. It might be time for the Department of Justice to change that, because frankly, those are established by rule by our department. But again, that's a really, really, really long answer, Chair Burdick, to your question. I think that Senator Posansky has probably identified one way keeping that information available to the public without releasing personal identifiers.
Would you be willing to work on language to get that in? And also, I had a question. There are two exemption sections in the public records law. One is an absolute exemption. One is a conditional one that can be appealed. Is this, I didn't look up the section in the statute. Is this under the conditional section?
No, Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is in ORS Chapter 192501 is the conditional. There's a balancing test that's applied in those instances. In ORS Chapter 192502, the vast majority of the 33, I think, exemptions that are in there, maybe there's 31 exemptions, are what are called non-conditional exemptions. They require essentially the public body to extend the confidentiality. Now, that certainly is the case here in 27. 27 happens to be one of those that isn't absolutely non-conditional because it puts the ball in the customer's court. The customer can affirmatively agree to have their information released. And now, again, as I said earlier, that doesn't require the public body to release that information, but at that point they get the discretion. Prior to that, they have absolutely no discretion as it's currently written.
Okay, so but if we could find some way of having like the meter location left open, there wouldn't be the same argument for making it a conditional exemption.
Sure. Again, that's policy.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, and maybe you're not the right person to answer this question, but I signed up for power, I signed up for phone. I just recently, as of last Friday, that's my first time signed up for city sewer and water. I've never thought to ask to keep my records private, and I had to give social security numbers and all these. So, I mean, in practicality, how many people actually ask to say, oh, by the way, keep this private if anyone asks?
Madam Chair, I think you hit the nail on the head. The question is whether or not you want to have the protection be a proactive responsibility of the customer or just be a blanket exemption, and that's the policy issue you're confronted with.
Okay, thank you. If you're willing to work with the proponents on some language that would solve the problem, that would be terrific to exempt truly personal information and stop it there. And then we have other people who want to string along with this bill, and Scott Taylor and Pat Schreiner are in that category. I assume you're both here on the Dash 4 amendment. Welcome.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Taylor, Chief of Community Corrections for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And the Dash 4 amendments, as proposed, are amendments that we support strongly. Those amendments, and that conversation was one we had with our community justice, our Community Corrections Commission, and that commission is made up of a district attorney, a sheriff, a county commissioner, community corrections directors, DOC, and we reviewed recently the management of sex offenders in the community. And one of the proposals that commission came to mirrors this proposal, that we have people that we have this information on that are working with treatment providers, and as is currently interpreted, we cannot release that information to those treatment providers, and we would like the authority to be able to, where we are, have somebody under supervision, and this would be valuable information for them to work on those issues or manage better. We would like that release. We are just supportive of the amendment as written.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner. I'm the commander of the Marion County Sheriff's Office Parole and Probation Division, and I'm here in support of the Dash 4 amendments on this bill, speaking for behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. Originally proposed these changes in another bill, very much in the way that Scott Taylor just described. It was really kind of a house cleaning measure as far as we were concerned, because we found that all of a sudden there was a restriction on releasing police reports to the sex offender treatment providers. We work, the folks that supervise and manage sex offenders in the community work very closely with the treatment providers. It's very important when you assess risk and manage these folks in the community that you have an accurate description of what their specific issues are, and so that police report is a key component of that. And so this would really address that issue. Without that, supervision, management, and treatment can be clumsy and uncoordinated, and that level of risk can be mismanaged. So it seems like a simple fix to us. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Does anybody on the committee have concerns with this Dash 4? Worried about it in any way?
I haven't read it completely.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Walker,
I'd like to hold on to this bill.
Well, we're going to do that, but I wanted to specifically ask about the Dash 4.
I understand that you probably want to hold on to this bill, but I want to hold on to it as well, because I've been working on an issue that came up when Senator Breyer and I visited my old elementary school. Law enforcement was disclosing the name of the mandatory reporter to the abuser. And now mandatory reporters in this particular school district have been fearful about doing their job as mandatory reporters because the abusers are showing up on their doorsteps and threatening them. And I have been pursuing that matter. Senator Breyer allowed me to do that. And I have some appointments set up this week to discuss this matter further, and I'm looking here at the Dash 4, and it says that any record made available to a law enforcement agency or community corrections agency shall be kept confidential by the agency, department, board, or physician. So I'm wondering how the heck this is happening, and I have grave concerns about it because it's happened on more than one occasion in Clackamas County, and I've had this discussion with Mr. Schreiner, and in passing, and he's sort of the one who led me to the other direction that I went. And so until I get my questions answered, I want to hold this bill in case we need to do something that's not happening.
Okay, we need to, whatever we're going to do on anything at all in this committee has to be done by Thursday at the latest. So
this Thursday?
This Thursday.
Well, I think I have my appointment before Thursday.
Yeah, like maybe tomorrow?
I don't even know what today is.
Okay, well, I specifically want to find out if there are concerns with the content of the Dash 4, because I want to give some direction to folks. It seems like a pretty straightforward proposal that you're proposing.
Well, the Dash 4 got rid of the special districts issue, so I would assume you would rewrite that.
That's correct. That's what I'm saying. But the content of the Dash 4, aside from the fact that it gets rid of the rest of the bill. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. What I'd like to do is go ahead and have the Dash 4 proponents work to recast their amendment to not eliminate the bill, but to tack on to the bill. Instead of so just make it a stuff, not a gut and stuff, and for the proponents of the bill to work along the lines that we discussed in the committee, and hopefully we'll have two good proposals for us at our next meeting as quickly as possible.
And Madam Chair, as regards the removal of the gut and stuff language from the A4 amendments, I'm happy to send a request down to Legislative Council on that. That is no problem, so you don't need a note on that. And then I assume maybe I'll hear from Mr. Neely and Ms. Ingram about the other stuff.
Yes, everyone, okay. I should have mentioned that. Everyone should work through Ms. Moad. It just makes life so much easier that way. So we will now close the hearing on House Bill 2599 and open a public hearing. Before I forget, I'm going to move House Bill 2323 till tomorrow's meeting. We will have the public hearing there. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2667. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2667 expands the definition of sex crime to include public or private indecency if the person has a prior conviction for either of those crimes. The SMS lists out what a person has to do in order to commit public or private indecency. The current Oregon law, if a person has a prior conviction for another more serious sex crime, then a new conviction for public or private indecency would be considered a sex crime. This bill would add to the list of requisite priors the actual public or private indecency crimes. There was another bill floating around on the House side, just so everyone knows, that would have made public or private indecency a sex crime at a first offense. That bill was not supported by the House members. They preferred this bill because of the broad definitions of public and private indecency. They did not want a first-time offender to be on the hook.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Schreiner, you're back up again.
Madam Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Can I ask a question as counsel, please?
Please do.
Ms. Moad, how can the person be held guilty under Oregon statute for an act that was committed in another state that was not illegal at that in that state at that time? Why is this not ex post facto?
Senator Whitsitt, can you point me to what part of the bill you're specifically referring to?
You're saying that if someone had committed an act in another state that was illegal in Oregon, that they can add to or enhance the sanction against that person in Oregon. If it wasn't illegal in the state where they performed the act, I'm really fuzzy on how that's possible.
Senator Whitsitt, I apologize. If that's what I said, I certainly did not mean to communicate that. The only time that a prior act outside of the state would potentially be used against an individual here is if they were criminally convicted of a crime outside of the state, and that criminal conviction outside of the state was the same or similar as the crime here in the state. So, for example, because I'm not doing a very good job of explaining this in the abstract, let's say that a person had a theft in the first degree, a felony for stealing more than $750 here in Oregon, and that theft in the first degree conviction made them a repeat property offender upon their second theft in the first degree conviction here in Oregon. But let's say that their theft in the first degree conviction was actually in California, and I'm making this up, but let's say for the sake of argument that California's definition of theft in the first degree was a $200 minimum, then that would not be a prerequisite here in Oregon because it would have to match Oregon's definition of theft in the first degree. So even if, whatever I said that led you to believe out-of-state behavior could count against some. Somebody, I apologize because that's not accurate. Mm-hmm. It would have to meet the statutory definition here in Oregon, and they would have had to have been criminally convicted.
Thank you, counsel. It's getting late in the day, and perhaps I misunderstood you.
It's getting late in the day, and perhaps I said the wrong thing, sir.
Session. Let's finish.
Yeah.
Mr. Przanski.
But in that same situation, if the California, if the conviction or if the law was for $1,000 or more, greater than what we had in Oregon, then that would be acceptable.
Senator Przanski, that is correct. Yes.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I'm still Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm once again speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network in support of now House Bill 2667. I knew this one was on the agenda, so I have some written testimony, and I know it is late in the day and late in the session, so I'm not going to, you can obviously read most of that yourself. If you skip down to the third paragraph, we're kind of talking about, one of the reasons we're talking about a second conviction of public indecency is we're not looking to widen the net on registration to the point that you're getting somebody who is intoxicated and urinates in public or is involved in streaking behavior at a youthful, indiscreet age. However, in the fourth paragraph here, there is some data that we pulled together when we started discussing this bill this measure on a statewide basis. And what that tells us is there is a group of people that we have concerns are, and they tend to be people who have been convicted more than once for this kind of crime. We reviewed data that indicated that there are 297 offenders statewide on supervision for public indecency as of December of 2004. Out of this number, 61 of these offenders had a prior public indecency conviction, or 20%. The state police that keeps all of this data reported that they had 2,306 people in Oregon who had been convicted of public indecency. Of those, 424 had a second public indecency conviction, which is 18.5%. So those percentages seem pretty close and pretty accurate. Their data also indicated that 144 of these folks had three convictions and 28 or five had five or more. So we're trying to get at the people who we know, who we're supervising, who create that greater risk. People who have a propensity, it's much more of a characteristic, and they're acting out. And that's where we think registration would help. We would break down their ability to be anonymous and look to contain and control them in the community. That's the way our evidence is for higher risk sex offenders, is those folks who do get convicted of a prior sex offense and continue to act out tend to have a much greater risk of reoffending. So with that said, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2667, and we will take it up later in the week. And we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2156. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2156 would ratify the National Crime Prevention and Privacy Compact, which is a federal compact, into Oregon law. Congress approved that, Congress approved the National Crime Prevention and Privacy Compact with the idea in mind that they would organize an electronic information sharing system among the federal government and the states. My understanding from sitting in on the testimony the last time this bill was up on the House side is that while this ratifies this into law, I don't know from a real practical state how much it changes current practices. It just helps Oregon when they become a party state by ratifying the compact, and I will let the witness explain that better.
Okay, Ms. Whitfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Patricia Whitfield, Section Director of Oregon State Police Identification Services Section, and I am testifying in support of House Bill 2156. I will summarize my testimony as late as it is in the day and hopefully have more time to answer any questions you may have. The gist of this bill does not change anything that is currently taking place for the exchange of criminal histories within the state of Oregon. The compact specifically addresses non-criminal justice background checks. Those would be checks done for regulatory purposes, employment, working with children, elderly, fiduciary-type positions. Oregon has been involved in two main programs with the exchange of criminal histories and the improvement over the years. First in 1983, the Interstate Identification Index, and in 1995, we became a participant in the National Fingerprint File Pilot Project. That particular project was means to demonstrate that the exchange of criminal history information electronically and the improvements that have been made over the years would, in fact, be a benefit and work well for states. Then the compact was ratified by Congress and left each state to ratify individually. Again, the background checks that we've been performing and the exchange of criminal histories does not change with this compact. There's no cost. There's no change to our infrastructure. It simply would allow Oregon to become a full participating member of the compact and have a voice on that particular forum for any changes in policy or procedures for the exchange, again, based on the non-criminal justice background checks.
Would this increase access to other states' databases, criminal databases, for non-law enforcement people who are doing criminal background checks? In other words, people involved in child protection or daycare centers, would they have more access if this were adopted?
Madam Chair, they currently do have access when it's approved by their legislative bodies, and it has been approved by the FBI. It's limited now, and as far as I know, will always be to a fingerprint check. They currently get all of the information that the FBI has to provide. The compact, as states ratify it within their own existing statutes, would be required through the National Fingerprint File and IIIA programs to make their criminal history information, full criminal history information, available to states that have that access. So currently, the agencies such as Department of Human Services, Department of Public Safety, Standards and Training, that have the authority to access criminal histories from other states now get the full access. But a state that might not be currently participating in a compact that would, in the future, would be required to provide all their full criminal history information.
Okay, I don't understand why we need this, I guess. I feel like Senator Beyer. If they can already get access to everything they need, why even have this?
Chair Burdick, again, and sorry for the confusion, it doesn't change the means that we have now to exchange information, but I know that the one thing it does do is allow for Oregon to be a voice in that particular process. And there's more and more background checks needing to be done, and the legislative body approves agencies, it seems, additionally each legislative session. It's a benefit we see so that those regulatory agencies who are having to make those decisions would have, in fact, all the information at their hands as much as possible. And yes, that is currently happening. There are 19 states currently that have so far ratified the compact. There's 4 states currently, Oregon being one of them, seeking to ratify it within the state. And as those states grow, then they would need to provide their full criminal history record information for all the participating states. So it could be an increased amount of access that they would have based on what the states that are participating would provide on the national level.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2156 and take it up later. And Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you. Where'd you want to go?